So I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack, and I'm going to talk a bit more about some of that other part of the HIV and mobility response. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Whadjuk Noongar people, the land on which we meet today. I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and I'd like to acknowledge the strength, resilience and capacity of the Noongar people and their culture. I'd also like to acknowledge any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here in the audience today. And in particular, I'd like to acknowledge the critical and central contribution of people living with HIV in my research and in the broader HIV response. So a broad sketch first of what I want to share with you today. The context of this presentation is that the profile of HIV infections in Australia has changed. A number of states, including Western Australia, have seen an increasing proportion of HIV infections amongst migrants and mobile populations, including heterosexual people. The evolving nature of the epidemic requires rethinking traditional approaches for different groups and in different contexts. What we have learnt from past HIV successes in HIV prevention and in public health more broadly is that a one-size-fits-all approach is not usually effective. And we've been working to consolidate a picture of mobility and migration in and HIV in Australia for the past decade, even though, you know, that seems to be new for some people, but we've been doing it for 10 years. In 2015, we launched the HIV in Australia Roadmap for Action, which to our knowledge was the first attempt to bring together what we knew about HIV in the context of mobility and to develop a range of strategies for action, and Roanna will talk about that more later, and there are some copies of this down the back. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the intersection between some of these groups. The eighth national strategy recognises mobile and migrant populations as priority groups, specifically culturally and linguistically diverse people from high HIV prevalence countries and people who travel to high prevalence countries. So in amongst other work with mobile and migrant populations in Australia who are vulnerable, we've been examining one particular group in this context, specifically in WA, where we've seen an increase in the proportion of notifications of HIV infections acquired overseas amongst men travelling, living and working in Thailand and Southeast Asia. So in today's presentation, I'm going to talk predominantly about Australian-born men who've acquired HIV overseas, primarily in those locations. A little bit of global context if you're not familiar with this area. We know that global mechanisms for HIV transmission are rooted in a panoply of social, political, economic and gender inequalities and are amplified by rapid globalisation and increasing population mobility. Recent estimates suggest that around about more than 3% of the world's population, about 258 million people, have migrated from their country of origin, and so populations on the move are increasingly vulnerable to HIV acquisition. Drivers for transmission include prevalence in country of origin and country of destination, risk perceptions and practices, lack of access to testing, treatment and health services, poor health literacy and myriad socio-cultural, political, economic and labour factors. The WA context, and Byron's in the room somewhere, and if I've mucked up your data, I just have to apologise now. So WA was one of the first states to report on changing epi around overseas acquired, and at the time, 10 years ago, it was posited the change might have been in part attributed to that mining boom that happened here and a rapidly expanding local economy with lots of frequent travel to Southeast Asia. Around about 40% of all infections in WA are now acquired amongst mobile and migrant populations. And of the nearly 1,200 notifications since 2004, 160 have been recorded amongst Australian-born men who acquired HIV overseas. I hope that's right, Warren. Of these, nearly 70% were acquired in Southeast Asia. Two-thirds reported their exposure category as heterosexual, and worryingly around a third, and this follows on from Nick's previous data, report their diagnoses as late. So what have we been looking at specifically? Graham Brown and colleagues were commissioned to do some research a decade ago to talk to men who'd been diagnosed in this context. And so we found that the social context and networks of men living and working in Southeast Asia were probably an important consideration. And so we've been exploring that a little bit further. So this is about the social network processes of Australian male expats, long-term or frequent travellers. I'm going to call them ELOFs. I know we hate an acronym, but it's just speedier to Thailand and Southeast Asia to determine how those networks might be harnessed for a public health intervention, particularly via peer education and social influence, which has been a critical and cornerstone of Australia's historical HIV response. Okay, so how did we do it? This was a grounded theory study, so I'm going to talk a little bit about some qualitative research and the importance of that in providing context. Symbolic interaction provided the theoretical lens. We collected data via a systematic review of HIV and STIs amongst expatriates, travellers to low and middle income countries. In-depth interviews with men, an observational study and content analysis of online forums used by those men in Southeast Asia, observational field work visits to Thailand across three time points, including setting and venue observation in Phuket, Pattaya and Bangkok, and interviews with key stakeholders in Western Australia and in Thailand. And from that, an explanatory conceptual model was developed to support the grounded theory. I'm not going to talk about the whole study because it's pretty big and there's lots of data. I'm just going to talk about some of the interview themes and what came out from that. So we found eight key themes that were really critical in influencing risk and social network development and social support amongst ELOFTs. And this included identity, pathways and motivations for expatriation, long-term and frequent travel, their experiences with place, which was often highly commodified and sexualised, how they made meaning of the adjustment process, this new normal, their perceptions and experiences of risk and risk-taking, how they gave and received support to one another, how they made sense of home on the move, and they spoke quite frequently about being in this liminal space betwixt and between Australia and Southeast Asia, and so the perceptions of country of origin and destination were really important. And all of this combined to develop a sense of community or communitas and how they made meaning through their social connection with one another. So I just pulled out a couple of quotes, particularly as it relates to risk, and I just wanted to use that to frame where we go with the prevention and interventions that we might do subsequently. So here are a couple of quotes from Jackson, Stewart and Bruce, and these relate to risk and to condoms. A lot of the guys here are older and didn't grow up with condoms. A lot of them have the attitude of, well, I'm 65 anyway, I'm going to be dead in 15 years. I might as well enjoy myself while it lasts. And Stuart said, it happened with the girl that I was with. We were smoking Crystal. There was a really strong bond, you know. And there were a couple of times when she said, don't worry about a fucking condom. It's all right. And Bruce says, you know, condoms for anal intercourse. And that had worked for me in Australia. I think I'd gotten one STI in my entire sex life up to the point I went to Thailand. I'd been in Thailand a month and I had to go and see a doctor and I had two STIs from one sexual encounter. In Thailand, my standard in safe sex was one where I got an STI immediately. I was like, holy shit. I had to reevaluate all of that. It put me off a bit, but not entirely. So I just wanted to highlight the multiple rationalities around risk that would demonstrate this kind of complex sense-making and thinking about risk, which was to do with expert and lay rationalities. We had some people who had been part of the HIV response previously and the whole thing changed when they moved there. People who were living with HIV, people who had had some pretty significant risk experiences. And overlaying all of that was this idea of intimacy and emotional connection. And for many who were often moving there after failed businesses and marriages, it was about karma and fate and just kind of having a good time while they still could. And here is Jackson just talking about managing risk. I had a condom break. Normally I'd tell the girl we need to go to the hospital and get a check. But if I couldn't get in touch with her the next day, if she had disappeared or whatever, I'd get a course of it. And he was talking about PEP. I got to the point of if the condom broke and there was no blood, I wouldn't worry about it. Because, you know, the chances from getting it from an infected girl are what? 1 in 1,000? Say at most 1 in 10 girls are infected. Well, the odds of having caught it are so minuscule compared to having an absolute month of crap and needing those pills again. So I wouldn't worry. And if there's blood, I would go to the hospital and get checked. And fortunately, I haven't had an incident where there has been blood and haven't been able to get to the hospital. So for now and for the foreseeable future, I use condoms, not for oral sex, but for penetrative sex. I want to be enjoying this place if it's still here when I'm 57, not dead when I'm 37. So there was certainly a level of managing risk and calculating risk and an engagement with some testing and treatment. So what did we learn? This is because Graham Brown is part of my research team, and anyone who knows Graham, he knows he likes a complex diagram. So This is for you, Gray. Really, this is just my attempt to overlay some of the interview themes around this idea of the grounded theory, which just speaks to how Australians become ELOFs over time and make a new home in Southeast Asia, but they're still anchored to Australia. They have this transnational identity, and it's constructed and reconstructed through interaction with others and their old and new environments. It involves an ongoing connection to their Australianness, as well as a desire to participate in local activities, culture and language. So to flourish in this liminal space, strong networks become important social survival skills. These require positive, rewarding experiences, local relationships, support from friends and family, social engagement and cultural connection. The development of social networks is predicated on a complex interplay of factors: identity, adjustment, support, pathways, motivations, risk, home and place were the processes and context through which ELOF's sense of identity and self was shaped, how social norms were communicated, and how a culture, an ELOF culture, was built. And this led to the establishment of community and communitas through which those social networks were established. They had large, socially patterned networks composed of a number of actors and assets, and the particularly strong social networks were seen with central, influential actors, particularly in beach locations of Phuket and Pattaya, and you know, we can look at a particular sociogram and there's everybody is connected to one central person, so there's quite a role for potentially for key opinion leaders. Generally, they indicate a small core network of strong ties, bonding together those with similar interests and values, but they had a wider peripheral network comprising weak ties with looser, less frequent connection, but this was a bridge to a diverse group with a broader set of attitudes and experience, which was important when often the values and attitudes held within the core network could often be quite health-harming. Both aspects of the network, core and peripheral, were important as they had instrumentality to strengthen or diminish health-harming or health-enhancing attitudes, knowledge and practice. And while there are many components of the network which we think could be acted on from a public health perspective, influential people points, so key settings and places, are probably likely to have the most traction, and these domains may act to amplify social capital and or enhance network capacity. So what are the opportunities? So through our systematic review, some of the work we've been doing over the last 10 years, there should be some utility of online interventions via the use of ELOF forums. They connect there, it's a social network, and they are receptive to information through those spaces. Closer work with GPs and travel medicine providers around testing and prep, given that most participants indicated that they had been tested at some point in time and were interested in new testing technologies and treatment. While potentially resource-intensive, a setting-based intervention working with peers in country may have utility, and we have an office of a FAO in Bangkok, so there are some opportunities, I think, that we could look at there. We did need to do a little bit more network analysis, I think, just to kind of unpack those really tight networks more. Cautiously, a public awareness campaign, I say this with a question mark and a caveat that if we do that, it has to be grounded within a broader program of work. We have tried it. It didn't evaluate well the last time Gray and I evaluated it. So I say it has some utility, but it isn't the silver bullet. So some other work that we're WA is doing is a follow-up study to Graham's, looking at the most recent group of men who've been diagnosed, to ask them a little bit more about additional factors influencing acquisition and to determine their appetite for various intervention strategies, including knowledge of and engagement with PrEP, and also a broader survey of practices and behaviours related to HIV and other STIs amongst Australian men who travel, and some cluster analysis to help segment further interventions. Some challenges I think are really important to keep to the forefront. Working transnationally means a challenge in understanding the diaspora and the impact of living in this liminal space between country of origin and country of destination. I think a critical consideration is that historically active participation by affected groups and individuals has been a cornerstone in the Australian HIV response. However, we've got this diaspora of people who live, and it's disparate. In this context, it's unclear what active participation means, or indeed what affected community means. Consequently, consumer and community participation in the development of strategies remains challenging, but is pretty critical if we're going to get it right. So in summary, at the commencement of this research and to date, there's been little published about the nature of overseas acquired HIV amongst those living in high-income countries, specifically Australia, and very much Graham's work has been the first to do that. The study offers insight into the personal, social and contextual factors that influence risk, identity development and social network formation. And in the context of population mobility, reducing overseas acquired HIV notifications in WA and in other jurisdictions experiencing that as well requires close examination of the connection between local and global and consequent complexity of networks, settings, behaviours, norms and contexts for risk and prevention. This and associated research that we've done over the last 10 years stresses the need for tailored and targeted strategies, an empathetic policy context that doesn't reify difference and that reduces stigma, and policy and practice that recognises the heterogeneity of priority populations. So now is the time to take all of that information and put it into a national coordinated approach to dealing with mobility and migration in Australia. So some acknowledgements. I just wanted to say these names because they have hung around for a decade with me as we've looked at some of this work. Bruce, Rowena and Graham couldn't have done that without you, and Graham's certainly been instrumental in getting this work off the ground. Corey, who coordinates the Community of Practice for Action on HIV and Mobility nationally. Lisa, Byron and co at the Department of Health, were indebted to you for spearheading this work and providing some funding support for it. Colleagues at Department of Health in the Northern Territory who also had provided some funding support. The WA AIDS Council, and in particular my former CEO, Trish Langdon, who really kind of noticed this early and was pretty dogged in pushing on this issue. And in Thailand, Empower, Swing, UNESCO, UNAIDS and Rainbow Sky and the COPAM members more broadly. That's me. That's us at the Community Practice. We do some dissemination. There's a bunch of papers. If you get in touch with Corey, she'll put you on the mailing list and you can have all of this delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening.